Hi, everyone, and welcome to the AI Innovators Podcast. I'm Rob May. I'm the CEO at Nova and one of the founders of the AI Innovators community. This podcast is about interviewing leaders, investors, executives, entrepreneurs, technologists, people that are thinking a lot about what's next in AI, people that are trying to innovate in the space. So I'm very excited to have as my guest today a guy I've actually known for a while at a fund that I really love, Radical Ventures. One of the general partners there, Parasvil Patel. Parasvil, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so I want to jump into this and I want to talk about the Radical Ventures culture because I think part of the reason you and I have been friends for a while is that back when I was a VC or as I've been an entrepreneur, you're one of the few people that we can have a lot of disagreements and we have had a lot of disagreements and a lot of commonalities too, but you know, you guys have all at Radical, I feel like, been very independent thinkers and are not afraid to say like, well, we don't see it that way. Here's what we're thinking. And we're going to do some of that today as well. So I'm excited about that. And you also seem to be one of the rare investors who acknowledges some of the uncertainty in spaces and business models and technologies. And so talk a little bit about like, what is the culture like at Radical? Because you guys only focus on AI. And so does it spring from that? Is it related to that? And like, how do you foster this attitude amongst a whole team?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it is something that we think about actively. As you know, Radical started a number of years ago, back in 2017. Our first large institutional capital backed fund was raised in 2019. That's when I joined the team. And when I joined the team, we were just a handful of us. And Jordan and Domi, who started Radical, and the entire leadership team's very deliberate in fostering the right culture and bringing the right people on board who essentially drive the culture. And I think there are two elements to this answer. I think you alluded to one of them, which is our focus on AI. So as we think about the world, and obviously everyone's talking about AI over the past few quarters, but we've been in this game for a little bit longer than that. And that gives us the benefit of having seen different trends, having seen a number of other companies both scale as well as some unfortunately not succeed in that journey. So that gives us kind of the benefit of that experience, which we can bring to our investing decisions and take a view which might not be the most popular view at that point in time, but we have that benefit of a little bit more of the history here. And that actually lines up well with the second point that I was going to raise, which is the diversity on the team. So we have a really good mix of people with entrepreneurial experiences who have had their own startups, including Jordan and Tommy, who have had multiple machine learning driven startups, people who have been in organizations before in operating roles, people who come from different investing backgrounds. So everything from early stage deep tech accelerator backgrounds to later stage investing experiences like I have to corporate VC experiences. And we also have a very strong network and both scientific partners and advisor group coming from academia. And that diversity of thought that exists on the team also helps us debate our investment decisions and how we work with our portfolio companies from multiple points of view. And that helps us kind of make, I certainly think, kind of better investing decisions. So I think both of those elements are kind of linked together, but the diversity on the team is a key factor. And then we obviously try to make sure that processes are aligned with the ultimate goal. So for example, our investment committee is not a small group of partners who make decisions, but our entire investment team, no matter how senior or junior someone is, everyone's on an equal footing in that discussion. And that helps bring that diversity and the diversity of thought and experience into those conversations. Otherwise, we might still have that diversity on the team, but if you don't let those voices in at the right time, we'll kind of lose out on it. So, and similarly, we have other kind of meetings and opportunities for everyone to contribute and shape not just the investing decision, but the organization. So I think those are some of the points I would say are kind of deliberately curated to drive the decisions that we make.
And so you guys are very AI focused. You've had a lot of different opinions. You're one of the few people, VCs I know, who like your opinions have sort of shifted a lot with some market data. We're in a time where a lot has been written about moats in AI. You know, there was some early stuff, I feel like, in 2017, and then it just kind of like, there wasn't a lot of maybe innovative thought there. But I feel like in the last year, with the rise of LLMs and then everything else that's been happening, it's been a lot of different stuff written about whether moats are vanishing, whether they're driven by data, UI, UX, or something else. So What are your latest thoughts on where you're expecting to see long-term moats emerge for AI companies?
Yeah, no, that that's a great question. I think, as you pointed out, there are a lot of tweet storms and hot pieces written about this. I think quite many of them do a good job, but a lot of them miss out in terms of aiming to get that kind of clickbaity headline and end up with a very reduced kind of version of what your argument should be. So I'm sure everyone's kind of heard of there are no moats and Google doesn't have moats, OpenAI doesn't have moats, et cetera, like all of those pieces out there. I think the answers are a lot more nuanced than no one has any moats or only there are only data moats or only the incumbents have benefits, et cetera, et cetera. So I think you can break it down into a few different pieces. I certainly think there are data moats. Those don't go away, but it's a nuanced answer. If your data asset is 100,000 blog posts on written about kind of some brand marketing for a bunch of different companies, then that probably is not a moat because most of these large language models have already been trained on either that or similar data. So that data is probably not going to serve as an amazing moat. But if you have access to a number of healthcare records, then that's differentiated data that doesn't exist out there, most likely is not included in the training data sets for these models and will definitely serve as a moat. So data for sure will continue to be a moat, but it's a nuanced answer on whether data in and of itself is a moat or not, depends on the type of data and what you do with it also kind of matters. We believe also similarly that depending on the type of business you're building, technology can be a moat. If you're building certainly a differentiated horizontal business, so we are investors in Cohere, which is a large language model business, the technology is a moat. Their models are significantly better performing than a number of other competitors out there. Independent benchmarks have shown that. So there is a technical moat there. And technical moat in businesses like those are tied to, in many cases, strong technical teams. So we like to back strong technical teams who can develop these technology moats in that business. I think AI does accelerate building of a number of these tools and apps and agents, but that doesn't change the fact that good old kind of execution still matters, right? You sure, the next person can build a quick app, but you still need to figure out what the customer actually values, build the right product, execute appropriately on the go-to-market, gain customers, and that eventually might lead to a distribution advantage. It might lead to you being kind of embedded into the workflow of a customer, and that gives you a stickiness mode. So all of those traditional, quote-unquote traditional, what I would say, modes, still exist. They become a little bit harder to get to, but it doesn't mean that they don't exist. So that's what I would say around kind of moats. I think they will continue to exist. They'll probably be tougher to get to, and it's a nuanced answer on which ones will continue to be moats versus which of your factors will not be a moat, but they'll certainly remain important.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree in that way of looking at it. And we're going to get to some of those nuanced answers in just a second. So you agreed to come on and talk about a post that I wrote a week or so ago called 5 Contrarian AI Theses for Early Stage Investors. So for those of you who don't know, I write this Substack, investinginai.substack.com, about things I see in the market. What's interesting about this is I only got 2 or 3 comments on it, but I bet you I've got dozens of people who texted, emailed, or called me to talk about it or say something about it. And so I don't know if people don't want to comment on it publicly or whatever, but my point, Paracel, is like, you're very, very brave to get up and address these points in a public fashion. So this should be fun. So we'll go through them and I'll talk to one and you can pick either side and tell me, you know, it doesn't have to be what you believe. You can argue whichever side you think will be more fun. Why you think, you know, this might be accurate or this might not be accurate. So first point, horizontal LLMs will lose. And so there's sort of 2 subpoints to this. One is that LLMs generally might get displaced by a new and better technology, and a company like OpenAI might just not be worth what we thought they're worth. Or the second version could be that LLMs verticalize to the extent where just the market for a horizontal solution is not quite there. So what's your take?
Yeah, so I think this is one of those places where there are a lot of these religious divides on, it's only open source LLMs that will win, or only the horizontal LLMs will win, or the Google OpenAI have no moats kind of argument, etc. I think the answer is nuanced. The answer is not or. The answer is and. Again, this is my belief, so I might be wrong, but I believe that there will be horizontal LLMs. That doesn't mean there won't be vertical LLMs. They will also exist. It does come down to what is the use case that you're going for and what is the best tool to do that job, right? So if you have a general purpose LLM from Cohere or OpenAI or Anthropic that is phenomenal for your particular task just out of the box, you'll most likely just use that particular tool versus thinking about kind of creating a fine-tuned version for your particular use case. Now, for things like healthcare, which is where domain-specific data, as we were just talking about, kind of matters, probably vertically specific LLMs, whether they're fine-tuned LLMs or built from scratch LLMs, will probably have an advantage. So I think it will come down to the use case, and that's how they'll evolve. I also think Cohere or OpenAI are not going to sit still, right? So they will also continue to evolve. So while horizontal LLMs don't get used for all of these approaches out there, some of these companies will make it easier for their models to be fine-tuned and used in different use cases. So that's I'd say I agree that horizontal LLMs will not take the entire market, but I think the answer on how the market kind of gets divided is slightly more nuanced.
Yeah, I think your last point there is one that I really like, and I think enough technologists and particularly investors don't think about, which is this reflexivity between a market and a product launch. And we kind of look at it as like the market wants a thing and you either provide it or you don't. But the truth is, you get a product out in the market and the things you do start to shape how the market thinks about things, right? And how your competitors think. And there are lots of products that when they're launched, you think, well, this is only applicable to companies like X, Y, and Z. And then once it's been out a couple of years and you make something easier for everybody, it starts, lots of people start using it. So then you can shape different use cases. So it's a really interesting way to think about it. So number two, I argue that AI won't impact full markets the way a lot of previous tech waves have, but instead will only impact specific companies. And what I mean by there is VCs are very used to saying like, well, here's the impact that cloud's going to have on the fintech market, or here's the impact that mobile's going to have on e-commerce. And there are some broad brush applications and changes that happen because of that. My point here is that you could argue that since AI has different assets, primarily data sets that it responds to, that two companies in the same market, based on their value chains, might be dramatically differently impacted by AI. And so it's harder to use those, paint with those industry level brushes the way we have for other technology advances. What do you think?
So I would say I agree with, I think you'll see me repeat this again, it's around the nuance on the definition of a market. So if you are defining, all enterprise software, A, B, or C happen, I think that's probably too high level of an analysis that looks good on a tweet, but probably misses the nuance for actually how things happen. But if you're looking at markets defined slightly more narrowly, so say search, online kind of internet search, that for sure, you can say that entire market's going to be affected by LLMs. And we've already seen that happen over the last few months. U.com, one of our portfolio companies, was first to the block on having allowing kind of conversational search interfaces. Rapidly, the couple of incumbents in the category have already kind of followed. And we are seeing that entire category change pretty substantially. So in when you define market to mean something that is slightly kind of at a smaller level, yes, I think there will be categories that will be completely dramatically affected. But if you're thinking of like enterprise software at that high level, probably I think it's too high level for it to have any kind of generalized impact that's meaningful. I mean, you can say things like, there'll be a broader productivity boost in the services sector. Like, sure, but specifically different companies will have different impact depending on what's the exact mix of their labor force and the services they provide and so on.
Right. So what I'm learning about you from these answers is you're not a fan of strategic thinking by TweetStorm.
So, yes, I'm not. I'm generalizing here, but some of the TweetStorms are nuanced and are very well thought through. But most of the stuff that's clickbait is probably lacks the nuance.
Yeah, they should put as much thought into the core content as they do the headline, and maybe we get better outputs. Number three, this is one of my favorites, and I think probably one of the most controversial statements you can make. AI will kill most forms of competitive advantage. Now, this idea has been around in various tech waves for a while, which is this is innovation comes more and more, that there aren't long-term moats, there aren't long-term defensibilities, you know. And then obviously we had you referenced it earlier, Google's We Have No Memo as an example. Will AI make everything so easy that there is no more competitive advantage? Will competitive advantage shift? Like, what's your general take?
Yeah, so I think this goes back to the discussion we're having on moats. Competitive advantage is another kind of way of defining moats. So I do think that some of these tools that are being built and some of the technology that we now have access to makes it easier and faster to build new applications and start from scratch. Having said that, it doesn't kill all forms of competitive advantage, right? Because think of Salesforce or HubSpot in the CRM category, right? Like the stickiness that they have, the enterprise appeal they have. Yes, it's significantly easier to build a CRM now with the database technologies that you have. You can probably put an LLM on top and make it a conversational CRM and so on and so forth. But that doesn't change the fact that you still need to build a whole host of enterprise-ready capabilities and features, and that's going to take a long time to build and incorporate. And then the brand and the advantage that some of these incumbents have around stickiness, will you'll also need to build that and unseat an existing incumbent and go through that change management process at that enterprise. So I do think a lot of these traditional forms of competitive advantage still kind of retain. But yes, on average, it's substantial acceleration on developing applications, right? Like cloud did that. I think of this is another analogy that I use, which is actually a lot of these foundational models or that entire layer is analogous to what cloud did, right? Cloud made it super easy for someone to build a software application. This takes it one level further, but that doesn't change the fact that you still have to kind of build the right product, sell, and so on and so forth.
Gotcha. No, that makes a lot of sense. So point number four, and I actually wrote a whole post about this a couple of months ago, but AI will bifurcate the economy into the real world and the AI world. And what I mean by that is you might need different investing strategies, different mental models and everything else for things that are impacted by AI and things that aren't. And the distinction that I always make is concrete dries at the speed that concrete dries. And maybe AI can come up with a slightly better formulation that'll dry a little bit faster. But AI is not going to enable you to put up, you know, the Taj Mahal in 3 days, whereas there are other areas that AI is going to change by 30, 50, 100x or more. Mm-hmm. And so that might happen, and that might create a lot of economic and financial problems. What's your take?
So I agree 100% with this. I think there are a lot of companies that are jumping on the AI bandwagon with a .ai domain name and are getting pulled up into the hype cycle as AI companies. But if you are, as you were rightly mentioning, if you are in the business of building buildings, yes, AI and robotics can help dramatically. But some of these things, you will still have a physical goods supply chain. You will still need to get all those things in one place and then build something. So those principles of physics don't change. So I agree. I think I do believe that AI will help every business. For some, it will be a transformative order of magnitude change. For some, it'll be an incremental basis points EBITDA improvement. So yes, we shouldn't lump all companies together, and all of them are not to be looked at the same way just because they have a .ai domain. But yes, I think AI will help, and we should kind of look at how it'll actually help before kind of jumping to any conclusions.
Yeah, and so the last one, so point number five, I think this is the one I got the most feedback as a point that people hadn't really considered or thought about. And this argument is that customer acquisition channels will collapse into agents. And so by agents there, I mean, if you I'm sure you followed the AutoGPT thing. If you're mm-hmm. listening and you haven't, you should Google that and look it up. But people are interacting with agents via chat that go off and do tasks. And my argument here is that when we look at how companies go to market with inbound, email, events, PR, product-led growth, or community-driven go-to-market's really popular right now. If it's all going to collapse into agents, if we're going to use agents for everything, and we're ultimately going to ask our agents what we should buy, what we should use, and everything else, then all those go-to-market strategies sort of don't matter. And it's going to be hard to acquire customers without optimizing for the agents somehow. And I don't know what that looks like. And so I throw that out there as a controversial thesis of one possible future. I'm curious what you think. What's your take? Is it a likely future or an unlikely future? Or does it matter?
Yeah, I think it does matter. And I think of this as the evolution of marketing, right? Like before it was newspapers and radio and TV ads, and then we had the internet and blog posts, and we have brand marketing around like content marketing and email campaigns and so on and so forth. So I think this is the evolution of marketing. Certainly, actually, you talked about how we'll just ask our agents on what we should buy and how we should evaluate these different tools. And this is a category that I've been thinking about, which is like procurement and RFP processes and so on. And how can we optimize those using LLMs? Yes, LLMs will make it easier for us to read through a 50-page RFP document, summarize it, pick out the salient differences. But then it doesn't change the fact that you still need to, and maybe the RFP document was created by one of these AI tools itself, but it still comes down to you still need to kind of highlight what the differentiating factors are, why someone should choose your tool versus another tool, and so on. So it's more of an evolution of marketing than a revolution. And I agree, we haven't figured out exactly what this means in terms of how we present these differentiating factors, unique selling kind of points of a particular product or company online or in our content. But I think we'll figure it out, but it'll be an interesting journey. I think on the enterprise side, I think it's going to be this evolution. On the consumer side, I think that's where it'll start getting a little bit more interesting, right? If I can just go to an agent and say, book me a 5-day trip to Greece under $2,000, I don't need to search, I don't need to go to TripAdvisor, I don't need to go to booking.com, etc. And some of that's already started happening with the online kind of search changes that we discussed a few minutes ago. So that's where it'll start becoming more and more interesting. And then, yes, I think the integrations and the business models will start changing for sure. So this is definitely a space where we'll have to see how all of this evolves. One of my colleagues, Daniel, mentioned that he has this kind of akin to what you said, that in 5 years, like traditional websites won't exist and we'll just have kind of agents talking to agents to kind of get all the information and summarize it for you. So he, I think, agrees exactly with what you're saying. But I think before we get there's going to be an evolution and we'll kind of figure out our way through that evolution.
Yeah, well, if we have to live through, you know, whatever the equivalent was for SEO of keyword stuffing pages, if there's going to be an equivalent idea for LLMs where people are going to try to jam large parts of the internet with content that LLMs will scrape and train on, that's going to be messy. That's going to be unpleasant.
Yeah,
that's the end of the thesis. That was really interesting. I have one more sort of business and investing related question for you that wasn't part of that post, which is, you guys at Radical are pretty thesis driven, and you and I have talked a lot about things we'd like to see and in the market. What's one thesis you have where there's a conceptual company in AI that you would love to back, but like you just haven't seen it yet?
That's a great question. I think I'll talk about this on the application layer. One of the other analogies that a lot of people have made is the mobile revolution, and this is like the next kind of revolution from a tech cycle perspective. So if you think about the mobile revolution, I think a lot of people looked at a new iPhone and said, hey, there's an LED light in it. Let's build a flashlight app. And there were hundreds of them. I think we are seeing a lot of that happen on the application layer right now. A ton of copywriting apps and let me help you write a tweet better or a LinkedIn post better or an email better. But there were a few people slightly more than a decade ago who said, hey, this is a device that's connected to the internet, has a GPS navigation capability in it. Maybe we should build Uber on top of it, right? So like completely non-obvious kind of, at least at the first order level, insights. I think that those kinds of applications are super interesting, where you are completely reimagining the workflow in a particular function or industry because of the capabilities that have just been unlocked. I think most of the tools we are seeing right now have roughly the same kind of workflow. They're just adding LLMs on top. And in those cases, the incumbents obviously have a great advantage. But even if they don't wake up right now, they can wake up a year down the road and just add that same capability powered by the likes of Cohere in their tools. So I think that radical reimagination, pun intended, is missing. And that's what I've been looking out for. So if you have an application layer idea, which is not just, hey, everyone does this, and instead of this text generation in the middle, we now do it with LLMs. Not that, but something that's kind of completely different. Would love to hear from you. And obviously, we continue to back kind of horizontal infrastructure and platform businesses in the AI space. So obviously on that side, always happy to talk to folks building in the category.
Cool. Percival, this has been really interesting. I like to end on one a little bit more personal question, because a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs and investors that listen to this, and we all have sort of key moments in our lives where we've been given or read or learned some great piece of advice that's really helped in our career. So what's your one piece of advice that would fall into that category for you that you'd sort of like to share with everybody listening today?
Absolutely. And I think since you mentioned the audience here, entrepreneurs and investors, I think one piece that I heard early on was every job at the senior level essentially becomes a sales job. And I think that's definitely true. Like you are a startup founder, you're selling the vision to prospective employees, to prospective investors. You're an investor, you kind of, I crudely refer to it as you're in the business of selling capital. Having some of those skills, and it doesn't mean you need to be out there kind of being an account executive for 3 years, but having some of the skills on how to communicate well, how to convey your kind of narrative and get people excited about your vision, I think that's a really important skill to have. And it's a skill that you can actually work on and build. It's not an innate. Some people might have the innate ability, but others can work on it. It's something that I personally also am always working on. So I think that's one piece of advice, which is, I think, served me well. It's also always top of mind for me because I'm continuing to kind of get better at it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I always tell founders sort of a similar thing, which is a big part of the job is just convincing people to do things that may not be in their best interest, right? Like customers to sign up for an early product and employees to join what, you know, is an unlikely win and investors to put in money that they might likely lose. So it's definitely a good skill to learn. Well, this has been awesome. Parisville, thank you for being on today. And those of you listening, if you want to know more, you can learn more about Radical at radical.vc. And we hope you'll go and listen to the rest of our episodes.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate you having me and look forward to having these conversations both on the podcast and offline.